This is Pittsburgh Explainer, a new podcast from 90.5 WESA. Every Friday, our reporters are here to help you understand some of the biggest news stories from southwestern Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Liz Reed.
And I'm Chris Potter, editor of the Government and Accountability section.
I'm Billy Driscoll, arts and culture reporter.
And I'm Lucy Perkins, politics and government reporter.
It's Friday, February 21st. Today, Democrats in disarray. And no, we're not talking about the presidential primary. Locally, the Allegheny County Democratic Committee has come under fire after some controversial endorsements last weekend. And a new report shows growth and inequity in Pittsburgh's art scene. Finally, a look at congressional primary matchups this spring. We'll dig into these stories right after the break.
On Saturday, February 22nd, the Pittsburgh Community Broadcasting Community Food Connections Initiative will be hosting a check-in for the 15th annual Southside Soup Contest at 67 Bedford Square, the home of WYEP and WESA. Bring a non-perishable food item to the station for the Brashear Association Food Pantry and check in for the contest from 11:30 a.m. until 2:30 p.m. The contest is a fundraiser for the Brashear Association and Southside Chamber of Commerce. For more information, visit WYEP.org/food.
And we're back. Chris, you've been busy all this week covering the drama and infighting within the Allegheny County Democratic Committee. Yes. It reached a fever pitch Wednesday afternoon when party chair Eileen Kelly and Pittsburgh City Councilor Anthony Coghill held a press conference. What were they trying to communicate?
I think what was going on there was there were a series of, as you said earlier, there were a couple of very controversial endorsements made on Sunday when the Allegheny County Democratic Committee gets together and endorses candidates that party members think are worthy of the voters' consideration. And if you get this endorsement, you get to be on a slate card and you know that they've got the stamp of the party's approval. And there have been calls since then to sort of reform the party. Maybe we need to change the rules. Maybe we need to think through whether we should even be doing endorsements at all when we are endorsing somebody who, as one of the endorsed candidates did, went on social media and talked about, go Trump and Obamacare is a disaster. And
in 2015,
this
should
is in
say.
2015, yeah, this is several years ago. And the candidate we're talking about, Heather Kass, who's running to replace Harry Reidshaw in the 36th district. That's a district that includes Carrick, some other southern Pittsburgh neighborhoods, and a couple of the kind of working class suburbs next door. So she made these posts when she says she was struggling with medical bills and was really upset about the cost of health care. In any event, that endorsement was controversial, as was the fact that the committee endorsed a guy named Chris Rowland, who's challenging an incumbent, Summer Lee, in a district kind of next door, the 34th district. Summer Lee, the first black female legislator elected to Harrisburg from Allegheny County. So these are two really controversial endorsements. And the party got together to say, hey, I'm Eileen Kelly, the chair of the party, and we think we've got good rules here. We think this process works. This is the purest form of democracy. If you want to change things, run, join the committee yourself and work for change from within. Candidates who don't win the endorsement, essentially, it's their fault.
Did they, on Wednesday at that press conference, advance that cause of assuaging concerns about what's going on in the committee?
I don't think so. I have not heard from anybody who thinks who was upset before and who is any less upset now about the way things are going. There was sort of a moment early on that sort of boded ill for the rest of the discussion. Bethany Hallam, who is a county councilor elected last year and has been one of the voices calling most loudly for reform, showed up at this press conference.
And she is a committee member.
She is a member of the Democratic Committee. She was not one of the people speaking. It was basically Eileen Kelly, the chair, and Anthony Coghill, who is the chair of the 19th Ward in the southern neighborhoods of Pittsburgh. They were the only two speakers. Ms. Hallam showed up. She said just to kind of hear them speak. She was going to live stream it on her phone. And they basically asked her to leave. And so before we even get to their attempt to sort of mollify this debate, we have the argument unfolding right before our eyes as reporters. And I've got some tape of that here.
I'm uncomfortable with her hair.
Yeah, I am too. Can you leave, please?
Can I watch if I don't record it?
You can watch on TV.
Then why can't we watch on Facebook?
Come on, Beth.
No,
I mean, we respect whatever you want. Please.
We're responding, okay? That's
we're
what
responding.
We're doing. This is our press conference, okay?
And she left. And she was apparently out in the hallway. She told the reporters later that she was basically sort of like listening at the door.
This is Lucy. Both Coghill and Eileen Kelly are not new to politics. It just seems like really bad press for themselves at a press conference where they're trying to unite the party, unite people like Bethany Hallam with more traditional Democrats or more old school Democrats, why would they even have this back and forth? It just seems like it totally defeated the purpose of the press conference before it even started.
Let me make an argument from the perspective of Eileen Kelly and Anthony Coghill. They were the ones who called the press conference. They feel and have felt for the past few days as though they have been attacked on social media, in media accounts like mine and other outlets. And they wanted this to be their time to respond to those accusations. So somebody walks into your press conference, and this is somebody who's been very critical of the party. From their perspective, they wanted a chance to kind of answer those. I think you heard Mr. Coghill kind of say that. We're responding. This is our time. You can have your press conference afterwards. And she did.
What power does the committee actually have? I mean, do the candidates they endorse typically get elected? What's the committee's influence on the lives of regular people?
To answer that first question, the value of this endorsement. In a lot of races, it has almost no value whatsoever. Summer Lee won without the endorsement in 2018 and against an entrenched incumbent in Paul Costa. There are a lot of races where the voters themselves just blow off the endorsement. And in fact, it often happens that committee people themselves, who are supposed to be the ones voting on this, just blow it off anyway. They continue to support whoever they want. There are, however, some races and for some candidates that the endorsement can be important. In a judicial race, which is a race where people really don't know much about who's running for judge, you go in there and they're like, oh my God, I have to vote for somebody for common pleas judge. One piece of information you have probably is who was on that slate card that I got dropped off at my door the other day. Heather Cass, for her, it is important. Because she's got her sort of lane to victory is kind of older school, more working class Democrats for whom that endorsement may still have a bit of emphasis, a bit of influence.
Bill, you covered a new report out this month that looks at trends in Pittsburgh's arts and culture community over the past 5 years. It seemed like there was good news and there was bad news. Let's start with the good news.
Well, this is at first we should say this is a report from the Greater Pittsburgh Arts Council. They do sort of an update every 5 years. They call the report Culture Counts. The good news was that attendance continues to grow. Full-time jobs continue to grow between 2015 and 2020. They measure arts attendance up to about 6.9 million currently, which is really quite a lot. It's up about 40% from before. There's almost 4,000 full-time jobs now in the arts sector. The bad news has to do with the equity and how those benefits are being spread around, specifically along the lines of race. What they found is that just in one measure, in terms of support for arts groups and culture groups that serve communities of color, they receive proportionately less support, funding support, than do the other groups. It seems like there maybe has been a little bit of improvement in that area, in the sense that there's between 2012 and 2016, which was the most recent data available, according to GPAC, more total number of grants are going to these groups that serve communities of color, but the total dollar figures has grown by much less. There's still a lot of inequity going on there.
Was there a discussion of kind of causes there? I mean, was there a suggestion that there was a racial animus or bias, or was it a thing of, I mean, I know an issue for a lot of groups is the capacity to even ask for the money, right?
Or may not be able to hire like a development director.
Exactly, yeah. Is that what's going on? Is there something else happening that kind of explains this disparity you're talking about?
Nobody says this, but there's an implicit sort of racism going on here, right? That we don't value some groups as much as others for a number of reasons. Some of them might be that these groups are smaller. Some of the foundations, the Heinz Endowments and the Pittsburgh Foundation, have created programs specifically to benefit groups and artists like these. The Advancing Black Arts in Pittsburgh Initiative, for instance, does give out grants to people of various sizes, people and groups, to do projects. So there's certainly an awareness of this out there, and it looks like there's been some movement toward trying to rectify that imbalance or that inequity, but many people would say not enough yet.
How important is the arts to Pittsburgh's broader economic picture?
Well, it's pretty important. I mean, GPAC is a nonprofit arts advocacy group, so it's their job to sort of tell people that it's important for the arts here. You know, and 4,000 jobs in the picture of the total Pittsburgh economy is not huge. But they do point to things like spending on the arts. So arts groups themselves spend money to put their productions together and put their shows together, but also patrons of the arts groups come to communities and spend more money than they might have otherwise if they were not going to the show. Here's David Pankratz talking about that effect.
Restaurants are going to benefit. Parking lots are going to benefit. Babysitters are going to. So it's a way to really trace the multiple effects of arts and culture spending throughout an economy.
Yeah, well, that's just what economists call the multiplier effect. It's not only about drawing people to communities to spend money, but the more people who are spending money, those dollars get re-spent, and it kind of creates the ripple effect that he's talking about.
When I moved here in 2013, I was actually really surprised and impressed with Pittsburgh. Having previously lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, it seemed like Pittsburgh was really punching above its weight when it came to arts and culture. So how do we compare to other cities?
Really well, according to this report, in a number of ways. I think for the first time with this every five-year report, has sort of benchmarked Pittsburgh against other cities, cities of various sizes, San Diego, Boston, Columbus, I think, is in there, and just seeing where Pittsburgh stands in terms of things like arts attendance, support for the arts. And Pittsburgh ranks really high. I think it was like fourth out of 10 benchmark cities in this group in overall attendance for the arts, which is pretty impressive considering that Pittsburgh is not one of the bigger metropolitan regions on that list. Really good support from foundations sort of historically here, funding for the arts, also from government. So yeah, Pittsburgh in a lot of ways really does well in terms of the kind of support for the arts, in terms of both people giving money, but also just people turning out and enriching, you know, everyone's life.
Lucy, you've been covering local congressional primaries. The only incumbent congressperson with a challenger is Democrat Mike Doyle, who represents Pittsburgh, the 18th congressional district. How's that race shaping up?
Well, first of all, Mike Doyle has been in office for about 25 years now. He has two primary challengers this spring. One is Janice Brooks, who has challenged him for about four elections so far. I think she first ran in 2012. Another Democrat who is running against Doyle is a University of Pittsburgh School of Law professor, Jerry Dickinson. And Dickinson has raised a decent amount of money, much more than Brooks has. Brooks hasn't posted any fundraising numbers so far. But Jerry Dickinson's whole campaign is basically saying Pittsburgh is a blue city. It's a reliably blue district. Mike Doyle's been in office for 25 years. What is he bringing back to this district? We need to use this very blue district as a bully pulpit to talk about really progressive issues like climate change and really push the Democratic Party forward in a progressive way.
And specifically air quality.
Air quality, which he talks about in one of his campaign videos that he posted right before one of the Democratic debates.
And politicians, even some Democrats, take money from the fossil fuel industry and then lie, telling us we can wait to deal with climate change. This is Aria. I don't have time to wait.
So Aria is his daughter, who is featured prominently in this video where he's talking about air quality in Pittsburgh and how we really need to talk about climate change and attack this problem right now.
When he says politicians, is he talking about Mike Doyle?
I mean, he doesn't say that explicitly, but that's who he's challenging here, right? He is trying to push Mike Doyle farther to the left.
What's Doyle's pitch to voters?
So Doyle has been pretty quiet on acknowledging any challengers he's had so far. I asked him soon after Dickinson announced that he was running if he had any comments, and he said, you know, I'm going to wait for the filing deadline, which was Tuesday of this week, February 18th. And the day after, Doyle comes out with his own ad.
To have a sense of community, to understand that we're here to help one another, that's what I think it means to be progressive. And I think a lot of Western Pennsylvanians are the same way.
So there you have it. Doyle is talking about what it means to be progressive. So he's clearly trying to pitch himself as a progressive candidate.
I recall Doyle some years ago, back at the, I'd say 2008, 2009, trying to advance some climate legislation in the House. Could he not plausibly claim to have at least a fairly progressive record on some of these things?
Sure. I mean, totally. Last summer, he held a climate change town hall. He had experts come in to talk about all sorts of various solutions, but they were talking about things like making municipal buildings more energy efficient, which isn't a very sexy way to talk about climate change. It certainly is not as sweeping as something like the Green New Deal. But that's the thing. He does support things like efforts to combat climate change, but it's just a matter of how much he pushes those issues.
What other primary races are you watching?
Yeah, so there's only competition in one other primary race in the region. It's in the 17th Congressional District, which is Connor Lamb's district. It's Allegheny County suburbs and Beaver County. And that's actually on the Republican side. So Connor Lamb, the Democrat, faces no challengers, but there are two Republicans who want to try and unseat him this fall, Jesse Vodvarka and Sean Parnell. Parnell got a lot of attention when President Trump came to Pittsburgh and announced that Parnell was going to run against Lamb. Parnell's a Fox News contributor. He's a veteran. He's an author and has gotten quite a lot of attention in the region just as he kind of ramps up his campaign this winter.
It's time for a quick break. And when we get back, in other news.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and I'm coming to Pittsburgh to give a talk that I call Seven Things I've Learned, which is basically just an excuse to tell a bunch of stories and play clips and play video and talk about how we make our radio show, talk about stuff we have not put on the air and never will put on the air, and talk about things I've seen as a reporter that have stuck with me. It's Saturday, March 21st at the Byam Theater. Tickets at trustarts.org/humanities. Again, trustarts.org/humanities.
It's time for our segment called In Other News, where we recommend a story or other piece of media you should check out this week. Bill, what you got?
In the February 3rd issue of The New Yorker, the historian Jill Lepore has a piece called In Every Dark Hour, which was about how the United States dealt with rising authoritarianism in the 30s just as a community, you know, with the rise of Nazism and fascism overseas, but also the rise of a lot of those tendencies in America, the ways that sort of the community attempted to talk about what democracy was and how and if we should save it.
What was your feeling when you came away from reading that?
I think it's possible to come away from that piece being hopeful in the sense that if we really want to address this, and her solution, by the way, is mostly was public people talking about these things in public forums, even on radio shows. It was the willingness of people to talk about this in ways that it's not easy to see people talking about today that made it a little bit discouraging. But also her ending message is, if we really want to do this, we can do this.
You said they talk about it in ways we don't talk about now. What does that mean? Why aren't we capable of talking the way we were 80 years ago?
I think it's what she's seeing today is people sort of, again, siloed off. People don't have a joint set of facts to work from. In those days, people, you know, there were newspapers that had different points of view and things, but that there was support from the community to, say, host a town hall meeting and say, not just talk about an issue, but talk about what is democracy? How is it different than other forms of government? Are there things about it that we need to change? And what's preventing us from doing that today is nothing but the will. We just haven't addressed it in those terms yet.
Chris Potter, what are you watching this week?
This will be a topic near and dear to Bill's heart, I suspect. I've been reading a New York Times Magazine piece from last week about the German neo-expressionist artist Anselm Kiefer, who I first encountered when I was but 15 years old at the Carnegie International. Just these massive canvases sort of, you know, ladled over with like lead and straw and other things. And he's a German artist, obviously, and working through kind of that collective guilt about the Holocaust and its intersection with sort of communal sort of myth making. The writer, who's Karl Knausgaard, he was a big fan, too, and basically went and encountered Anselm Kiefer in his studio. And I am happy to report Anselm Kiefer lives up to everything I would have expected him to be just from looking at his work. He's a weird guy who giggles at difficult moments, rides around on a bike in his studio and pours lead all over canvases and stuff like that.
Lucy, what caught your attention this week?
This is an amazing docuseries on Netflix called Cheer, and it is about a junior college in a tiny little town in Texas that is the best competitive cheerleading team in the country.
Now, are you like a former cheerleader? Like,
no,
do you have any interest?
No,
in...
I have no.
No, she is not.
Excuse you. I think I have.
Jeez.
I think I have the positive attitude that would be maybe desired on a cheer team. I mean, watching this, you don't want to become a cheerleader, but you totally have like a respect for the athleticism of it. There are just so many injuries that take place, and you just have to be like really, really dedicated and in really good shape to do this. But the real star of this series is the coach. She is just this unforgiving powerhouse that almost everyone on the team has described as like their second mother or someone who they love just as much as their own mom. But she's so unforgiving and makes them like practice through injury after injury that you kind of wonder, is this all worth it?
That's Pittsburgh Explainer for this week. Thanks to my guest, Chris Potter.
Thank you.
Lucy Perkins.
Thanks.
And Bill O'Driscoll.
Thanks.
Our show is produced and engineered by Katie Blackley. Larkin Page Jacobs is our managing editor. I'm your host, Liz Reed. You can find all of WESA's reporting on our website, wesa.fm, and of course on the air at 90.5 FM. Thanks for listening. See you next week.